All right, folks, let's go ahead and get started. Man, everybody is pretty subdued this morning. Why is that? Let me pray for us and then we can get started. Father, thank you so much for this glorious morning. Thank you that you brought us here, Lord, and that you have a grand and glorious purpose for our lives. Lord, help us in this Advent season to just to face the darkness, the hope that we await for the birth of the Messiah, but also just the hope that we have in that Christ's death on the cross satisfies your righteousness and your justice, Lord. And thank you for rescuing us and not leaving us to eternal separation from you. And help us to see others with the eyes that you see them as we go forth to be able to build relationships with people in the ways that you would have us do. Thank you so much. May everything we do honor and glorify you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. So this morning, I'm going to help you enlarge your vocabulary. So how many of you are familiar with the idea of purgatory? Raise your hand if you're familiar with purgatory. Okay, so purgatory is spelled like, purgatory. Right. So purgatory is, on Wikipedia, is a Roman Catholic doctrine. I grew up with this, a place or state of suffering inhabited by the souls of sinners who are expiating their sins before going to heaven. So I'm going to modify that a little bit, and it's called, here, purgatory. P-E-R-K-A-T-O-R-Y, purgatory. And that is the anguished, prolonged period spent waiting for a fresh pot of coffee to be ready. So, yeah. So how many, I mean, you can substitute coffee, you can substitute tea, but anyway, there is a purgatory that I think we can all identify with. So today, you should have picked up two pieces of paper. One is a week 13 outline. This is our second last week together, our second last Sunday together. This today and next Sunday will be the last weekend we have together. So you should have an outline, and then I've also updated the recommended reading list. So I had handed this out in the first couple weeks, but I've actually amended it to include some extra works, namely God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective from J. Warner Wallace. And then also there is a link from Covenant Seminary that just came out last week from Dr. Mark Ryan. Actually, he is a member of the faculty, somebody I had for class some years back, and he actually wrote a blog post, and there's the link forward for 10 individual recommended podcasts that you could listen to that actually help you identify with how to engage with our particular cultural moment. So they're anywhere from NPR broadcasts, like Fresh Air is on there, but some others on how to build engage with art or other pieces of culture and be able to see that through a Christian worldview. So to take kind of what you've learned here and tools that you've learned here in class to be able to work with them and engage with culture. Okay, so the next two challenges we're going to go through are going to be two of them. One is going to be all religions lead to the same place, and then also being a good person is all that really matters. Just real quick, a review from week 12. We talked about a couple of challenges. Moral truths are a product of culture, and the entire list of problems that produces or questions that raises. I'm not going to go through all of them here, but they're on your outline there. And then number two, you don't need God to know what is morally true. Moral truths are a matter of personal opinion, and the questions that you can raise to be able to gently press into somebody who possesses or holds that particular view. Okay, now we're going to talk about all religions lead to the same place. I am pulling some of this material from J. Warner Wallace's Cold Case Christianity materials. These are really valuable. He's got a website, a podcast, a ministry that helps you engage from an evidentiary perspective. He's a former cold case detective, and he actually engages. He used to be an atheist, and he actually engages now from a Christian worldview in examining the evidence for the validity of the existence of Christ and the truth claims of religion. So how many of you heard the statement, all religions lead to the same place? How many, maybe the question is, better question is, how many of us have not heard that? So a couple of the responses, I've got them here in your outline. Have you when somebody says to you, all religions lead to the same place, I'm going to offer you a couple of ways to respond to that. Again, to in the framework of a relationship with somebody, to be able to gently press into those kinds of claims. First question you can ask is, have you examined all religions, or are you making a broad assumption? It's a fair question, and it really is an open-ended question. It's not really a yes or no question. An example would be, if you were hungry, for example, for homemade mushroom soup, you're probably not going to go out and just pick any old mushroom from your lawn, from your yard, right? From your garden. Some wild mushrooms look a lot like the kind you buy at the market. Both of them would fit nicely in your soup bowl. Both will satisfy your hunger. One, however, possibly the one from your lawn, might be toxic. That's why most of us are very discerning when it comes to something like mushrooms. Several varieties lead to death. In a similar way, some religious worldviews are also toxic. There's a close analogy. They lead to spiritual death. Why would you be more discriminating, here's the question, about mushrooms than you are about spiritual claims? Wouldn't you want to know not just the similarities, but the differences between these claims before treating them all the same? You guys follow in terms of being able to really draw somebody out in terms of what they have discerned or studied in terms of the differences in the in various religions or worldviews that are out there today. So to follow on with that, are you aware, here's another question you could ask that would be fair, are you aware of the differences between the historic views of God? This is in your outline as well. Example, Christians believe that Jesus is God, but Jews do not. Jews do believe that Jesus was a prophet, but they do not ascribe that he was God or co-equivalent with God. Both groups possibly could be wrong, so Christians and Jews could be wrong, but we cannot both be right given that our claims are contradictory, just in that very basic assumption about who we claim Jesus to be. Christians believe, we believe that Jesus died on the cross and then rose from the grave. Muslims, in point of fact, deny this claim. In fact, they find it profoundly offensive that God or Allah in their belief system would condescend to become human. If you imply that Jesus is God and you're speaking to somebody who is Muslim, that would be inordinately, enormously offensive to them, that God would actually become a human being. It's enormously offensive for that entire notion altogether. Again, both groups cannot be correct. Christians believe in a personal God. Buddhists, for example, are pantheistic and deny the existence of a very personal God. Again, both groups could be wrong, but they cannot be right. The major religious worldviews disagree far more than we actually agree. And those are just four major world religions that I've just talked about in the ways that we actually are different. We could all be wrong, or possibly one of them could be right. So, and then, again, the million-dollar question is, why would you believe that all religions lead to the same place when none of them agree on very essential claims? And that is a fair question to be able to ask somebody, again, in the context of a relationship. Any questions on that first claim, that have all religions lead to the same place? This is probably one of the most common statements or objections or challenges I hear leveled against Christianity. Questions, comments? Okay. All right, number two. I've heard this actually, just heard this just a few weeks ago, talking to one of our neighbors who had come to stay for a week or so at their cabin. And we, Steve and Dave and I, went to have a drink with them one night. And this was something that they had actually talked about. They were theists, raised in a Christian church. But this is one of the things that they actually said to us just a couple weeks ago, that being a good person is all that really matters. That there is no need, essentially, to be able to subscribe to a particular religious faith. It's the fact that you're a good person is what really counts. Under that, I've got some other subordinate statements that you might hear that are similar. You don't need God to have a basis for moral values and human rights. Again, being a good person is what matters. Also, the statement, you're free to live as you see fit, as long as you don't harm others. It assumes that as long as you're a good person, that that's what really counts. Those two statements kind of go alongside of being a good person is what really matters. So you don't need God to have a basis for moral values or human rights. So I don't need God. I want to be in control of my life. I'm free to live as I see fit. I'm, again, in control of my life as long as I don't harm other people, in my view. So one of the ways to address this would be to ask the person, again, in your outline, are you a good person? How would you guys as a Christian answer that? I'm asking. How would you answer that? Are you a good person? Yes, Al.
Define the term good.
Yep. Yep. Yep, which is the next question. If the person, it would be really odd for somebody to say that they're a good person compared to maybe somebody else. They would be easy for them to say compared to Hitler, I didn't kill people. So what standard of goodness are you using, to Al's point? Everyone thinks they are good by their own standard. So that's a fair question, and it really elicits a great response where you can actually find out where somebody is in terms of the claim of being a good person. Here's an example. Hitler thought he was good. He really thought he was doing the right thing. He was convinced that he was doing the right thing for his country. When you say to somebody, being a good person is all that really matters, you are necessitating the existence of a true objective standard for good. So you're asking that person, what standard are you using for good? But when somebody says being a good person, they're indicating to you that they have some idea or some standard that they're going by to be a good person. So here we're talking about, are you asking about a standard that transcends personal opinion and cultural consensus? We talked about this a couple weeks ago about what it means to be good. Is it based on personal opinion? Is it based on cultural consensus? Like, for example, the standard that was held by the German regime that executed 6 million Jews. So that was considered to be good by cultural or personal opinions or consensus. So if being good is all that matters, then it's very likely that you need some objective transcendent standard that is outside of you to really point to something that is ultimately good. You're going to need to use God as your standard. What do you think about the claim that you can ask somebody that it doesn't eliminate the necessity for God but may actually require him? Because if it's not based on something that's based on personal opinion or cultural consensus, the only transcendent outside of yourself or outside any other personal view would be God. And that would be a fair question to ask somebody, to really get them thinking about where do you really get your sense of good. So going back to asking the person, are you a good person? And somebody says, well, I'm not as bad as so-and-so. Another couple of fair questions you could ask, again, in the context of friendship, not the cashier at Walmart. Don't ask them this. Have you ever lied? Have you ever taken something that wasn't yours? Have you ever tried to cut corners? Have you ever cheated on your taxes? Have you even thought about these things? I have thought about some of these things. We all believe the universal axiom statement that says no one is perfect. So no one's thoughts or actions are entirely pure. If being a good person is all that really matters, then inevitably you and I don't really matter because none of us are consistently good. So why would being a good person actually come into play? Why do you think anyone would think that they're good? Where does that whole notion of good actually come from in the first place? Okay, and the last, pressing in a little bit further again, if there is a God, why would you think good is good enough? If God exists, he is all powerful. He had the power to create everything in the universe from nothing. We call that in Latin ex nihilo, meaning that he created something out of nothing. A God that powerful has the power to eliminate all perfection, including moral imperfection. So if there is a God, again, a propositional statement, he isn't morally good. He isn't just good. We're kind of settling for something that's good. He is morally perfect. So kind of stretch somebody's thinking in that framework. So think of your best day. Here's a hypothetical situation. You may have been good, but you weren't perfect. The best day ever in your life. You may have been good, but you weren't perfect. I've never been perfect either. Only one man has ever lived the perfect life, Jesus of Nazareth, and he had an advantage over you and me. He was perfect. He is God incarnate. So why would you think that your goodness would impress a morally perfect God? There's a big distinction between the notion of good and the notion of perfect. Yes, Bill.
So what do you say to somebody who says, yeah, so there is a God and he created us, none of us are perfect, he's a forgiving God, so we're okay.
Yep.
So we do the best we can.
Yep.
So what do you say to that?
Yep. So you think of God, that's a great question, Bill, because it kind of like, how do you respond to that? One way to respond to it is you say that I have done some things. I've never been perfect either. In fact, like we talked about in the first couple weeks of this class was to think of God as being a judge. We are all familiar with the justice system in our country. It's not perfect. It's far from it. But to be able to think about, like, if I had been on the street and I had actually been mugged by somebody and I actually get to face my accuser in court, and the judge looks at the guy who mugged me and says that, you know what, the guy who was in here before you did a whole lot worse than you did. And you know what, this is your first offense, and so it's not that bad compared to everything else you've done, and so I'm just gonna give you a pass. I would not, as a victim, consider that to be justice, and that would not be a good judge. And God being a perfect judge, just imagine a being who is a perfect judge, and not, I mean, people just, we don't get a pass. We wouldn't call that a human good judge. To be on a human stance, we wouldn't call him a good judge. So a human judge that would do that would be flawed, and we would not call that good. So to think about there being an absolutely perfect judge whose sentencing is absolutely proportionate to the crime that was committed, I think everybody wants justice of some sort. We have all been sinned against, or we have all sinned against somebody, but I think everybody would want justice in some sense, one way or the other. So to appeal to that, I think a lot of people have, because they've been sinned against, they've been betrayed somehow, to appeal to that notion that God would give. Like, for instance, I was talking to somebody, a friend of mine, a colleague who was Jewish, and he was telling me, as an Orthodox Jew, that really they don't believe in hell. And I just looked him square in the face, and I just said, okay, Steve, so Hitler gets a pass. And he came alive, and he said, no. That guy, no, I would wish hell on him. And he just, like, immediately the sense of justice, this idea of good versus evil, extraordinary evil, rose up out of him. And so just that kind of appealing to the sense of fairness of justice really helps. Because a lot of people in a human stance, we can relate to that quite a bit. Okay. One more thing, I found this article on Cold Case Christianity on Jay Warner's website, and he talks about this article about what is so special about Christianity. And he says that every worldview takes a position regarding eternity. Even those who don't believe in God still believe about something about death and the possibility of heaven. To disbelieve a claim requires a belief in something contrary. And he says when he was an atheist, he believed something about eternity and the possibility of life after death. And when he was an atheist, he said he denied that there was a God, had no belief in supernatural phenomena or anything beyond the natural realm, and no belief in an afterlife. He said all the world's religious belief systems, on the other hand, posit that humans can work their way into God's presence through some set of good deeds, good behaviors. All proclaim a similar truth. You, as a simple human, can control or at least contribute to your own eternal destiny. He said, if you're a Jew, you obey the Ten Commandments. If you're Muslim, you obey the five pillars of faith. If you're Buddhist, you obey the implications of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. If you're Hindu, you perform good deeds that have to do with karma. If you're a Jehovah's Witness, you must perform good works that fulfill God's will. If you're a Mormon, you obey the Ten Commandments of Judaism, every commandment of Jesus, and the teachings of all the Mormon prophets. You see the similarity, he says. All these worldviews are dependent on the beliefs or works of humans. You either think you're smart enough to explain it all, atheism, or you think you can somehow unite yourself to God through your own good works. Christianity, on the other hand, proclaims something very different, he says. If you're a Christian, you're convinced that God is too powerful to be impressed with good deeds and that there is nothing you can do as a mere human to earn your way to heaven. Amazingly, God offers something that he has already done for you. Our good deeds might be good, he says, but they aren't perfect. Of the worldviews here, only one addresses the true powerful nature of God. Only Christianity offers the free gift of an all-powerful deity. Only Christianity offers grace and hope for those who know they are imperfect. Now here's the metaphor that he offers. If I place Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa in a room along with many copies I painted myself, you would notice two things. First, you would notice that there's only one true Mona Lisa. All my copies would differ from the original, even though they might share common characteristics. You'd also be able to identify the true painting. It would stand apart from the rest. It would have a property of singularity, marking it as genuine, he says. Second, you would notice the slight imperfections of all the other paintings. Everyone would show signs of having painted by someone who was far less gifted than the inspired artist. One painting in the room would reflect the nature of a gifted artisan and creator. The rest would reflect the nature of an ordinary man. He says, Christianity is the Mona Lisa in the room. It stands alone, bearing the unique, singular quality of grace. All other belief systems and worldviews share a common logical flaw. They are works-based and fail to offer the grace of God. And like the Mona Lisa copies, they are all alike in their imperfection. You can spot the truth about eternity in the same way you can spot the true Mona Lisa. The Christian offer of salvation stands out from the rest. It possesses a property marking it as true. Other worldviews display common imperfections, each having been created by people who are far less gifted than the inspired artist. One worldview, Christianity, reflects the nature of the gifted artisan and creator. The others reflect the nature of ordinary men. Christianity, he says, stands alone, bearing the unique, singular quality of grace, the undeserved free gift of salvation. Okay, any questions or comments? We're gonna, enough of me talking here. There is at the bottom of your outline, one of my favorite things to do, which is a case study. So if you picked up an outline, you'll see at the bottom of your outline, the case study. It's the night of your weekly Bible study group, your weekly growth group. During the discussions of the Sunday sermon on the Great Commission, a newcomer to your group remarks, "Who are we to say Christianity is better than any other religion? I think the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, the same as all religions. It's not our job to tell other people how to live or believe." The rest of your group fidgets awkwardly but says nothing. How do or how might you respond? So I'd like for you guys to take like 10, 15 minutes and talk about that at your tables, please. Okay, guys, let's go ahead and bring it back in. Okay, what did you guys think about the whole statement about who are we to say? ... First of all, let me ask you this. Is it safe, is it wise to assume that your newcomer to your growth group is necessarily a professing Christian? Do you know that person? Right, you don't know them, exactly. Do not assume to know anything necessarily about where they're at, spiritually speaking. So what would be like one thing you could do if you don't really know where that person is spiritually? What's one question you could ask, like, how did you come to that conclusion, right? That was one of the most fundamentalized, one of the first questions we've talked about is how did you come to understand that? And what has shaped what you believe, right? Okay, so what do you guys think about the statement, who's to say, or who are we to say? Another closely related statement is what gives you the right? I'm sure all of you have heard that personally said or overheard that said by other people. What gives you the right to tell other people what to believe? Right, or who's to say what we should believe? Okay, what do you guys think about that statement? Is it really rights that we're talking about? Is it really rights, like human rights, or is it really your credentials as a Christian you're talking about? So the rights that you're appealing to, when somebody says that, one way to respond when somebody says, the statement is meant to leave you like dead in your tracks, because how do you respond to that in a loving and compassionate and really kind of intelligent way? The rights that you're appealing to are rational rights, solid, critical thinking. It's an argument, objective truth, again, an argument that stands or falls on its own merits. It's an objective statement as opposed to the authority of the speaker, which is a subjective statement. So you're talking about rational critical thinking. So I want you guys to think about pointing the arrow or the focus onto the argument that you're making, not to you. Okay, so who's to say the statement, ultimately the person who has the best reasons and the best position is in the best position to say what is true and what is false, right? This is the way sound thinking has always worked. Somebody who has the best reasons. So who are you to say usually means also you're wrong for saying someone else is wrong, right? You guys see the contradiction in that statement? You're wrong for saying someone else is wrong. Okay, so if the claim, again, remains in a question, it's hard to notice that kind of a contradiction. So to turn that around and be able to query the person about who's to say, what are we talking about here? Are we appealing to somebody's opinion, consensus, feelings? Or are we really appealing to rational thought? Okay, so any comments that came out of your group discussion in terms of who's to say that Christianity is better than any other religion? Yes, Jenny.
To declare
excellent
about life. And if he did that, do you think that stemmed from love or from hate? You know, and kind of work forward from Jesus as that authority, since that's what they're questioning.
Yeah. Yeah, so like what did Jesus say about how to live? An appeal to him, which is the thing to do. Check out Jesus. He is, quote, the main prophet for Christianity, the leading figure for Christianity. Yes. Yeah. What did he think about how to live? What did he say? Yep, great. Anybody else? Who else? I know you guys, I could hear all of you plotting to overthrow something, so. Anybody else? Yes,
Life. My table agreed that my confrontational style and trying to humiliate the person was not the right approach. But I mean, the reality is we do it all the time.
Yeah. Right. Tempting, isn't it, to humiliate somebody?
No. The statement, who are you to what I mean, but as people in society, we do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We tell people how to live, we tell people what to believe. It's just that we do that based upon the fact that we believe something is true.
Mm-hmm.
Like we do that with math, right?
We
do that with finance, we do that with all these things. And in this case, right, it almost seems like there's a preconceived notion that this isn't actually true.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an opinion. So, I mean, it seems like that would be a good way to sort of maybe my wife's approach, which is, you know, just to say, let's have this conversation, right? This is really interesting.
Yeah.
Point to make. Because the actual religions you're talking about are the ones who are actually saying that they're the right.
Yeah. Yeah, they're telling people how to live, which is actually is a fair claim that you can make. Do not all major world religions actually have an outline or a prescription for how you are to live? So it's not entirely intellectually honest to isolate Christianity as being the only religion that tells you how to live. Yes. Yeah, good point. Yeah, absolutely good point.
And also, Christianity is an older religion that says it's better than
people.
Like, all of the religions say, like, this is the right one.
Yeah. Yeah. So the subjective statement about who are we to say Christianity is better? What might be a better way to better way to actually rephrase that? Who are we to say Christianity is like? How can we portray Christianity as being true, not necessarily better, true? We're appealing again to rational thought. And I know the idea of critical thinking is not an entirely popular methodology right now. We have, as a culture, have largely sold out to our feelings, and we're ruled by personal opinions, we're ruled by personal feelings. We don't want to face things that are sad, like Jeff was talking about in his sermon. We don't want to face bad feelings. So to appeal to rational thought is not entirely popular right now, but there is, God will grant you a way to be able to speak into somebody's life in a way that will make them, help them to see that this is true. You're really appealing to truth. We've talked about how to be able to talk about and respond to arguments about there being no objective truth. So, okay, any other comments, you guys? Yes, Lauren.
This wasn't what we discussed at the table, but I just, for whatever reason, it just caught my attention. I just noticed it. But they start with, who are we? And then follow up, the next statement is, I think. which is curious to me, where it's like, who are we to say? And then it's like, I think. So suddenly they've taken away authority from one and then given it to themselves.
Yep.
And then made a claim with that and then stemmed from there.
Yep. Excellent observation. Who are we? I'm part of the group. Who are we as Christians? I'm in the safety of the group claim here. But then I think that what Jesus taught was all about love. Yep. How would you guys respond to, Jesus said to love everybody. How might you guys respond to that? That Jesus, the essence of Jesus' teaching was love. Yes, Jamin.
That was, I was kind of hesitant to approach this point because I felt like it just might just as likely turn somebody off to the gospel of Christ rather than introduce them to it, is just confronting the idea that the essence of Jesus' teaching is love, because I think that's a complete misrepresentation of the gospel. Mm-hmm. The essence of Jesus' teaching is himself. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through me. It also says that God is love. You know, he who does not love does not know God, because God is love. So there's that idea that, yes, the essence of teaching is love, but Jesus is also saying that I am. That is the essence of Jesus' teaching. I am. So in essence, I'm not teaching Christianity and the idea that love is a byproduct of Christianity. I'm teaching Christ because Christianity is Christ.
Yeah.
So to be a Christian is to follow Christ. And I think that's challenging because you're like, I'm kind of obsessively preaching a person.
Yeah.
Not the byproduct of that person's teachings or the positive lifestyle and worldview that comes from what they teach.
Yep.
I'm preaching that person. I'm preaching unification with God, love, happiness, all those things through Christ himself.
Exactly.
And so, and that I think is like, well, if you're getting Christianity, you're getting Christ himself, the nature of God. So, and that I think is like just as likely to freak someone out.
Yeah, somebody, great, Jamie, great point that you're getting that, you're getting Christ, you're getting that person. Like the thing that drew me to marry Steve is that he is an extraordinary person on his own. He loves God. He pursues him with all of his might. The fact that I'm married to him is a bonus for me. It has nothing to do with me. It's that whether or not I'm married to him, it's him who I want. In other words, he is beautiful on his own. And whether or not I'm married to him, it doesn't detract at all from the beauty that I see in him as my husband. I'm just a beneficiary of being married to somebody like that. Or a work of art like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's beautiful on its own, and you admire it for its beauty. The fact that you get to hear it and you're wired to love it and be moved by it is God's image in you, but the work stands on its own, and Christ is who you want, not the stuff, or the, like you said, Jamin, the byproducts, the consequences, the good things. Do we want Christ, or do we want the stuff that we get from him? There's a big difference, and that's a great point to make with somebody who is thinking through what Christianity is. Like, do you want the stuff that God, or that you get from Christ, like your best life now? Nothing against Joel Osteen, but is that what you, I mean, do you want that? Or, I mean, there's so much more. That's like a shorthand, a short view of just the life and the here and the now. There's not an eternal perspective. There's a whole lot more than just your life here. Okay, you guys, we have one more week left. We're going to tackle the two biggest questions next Sunday, which is, why is there evil and suffering in the world, and how could a loving God send people to hell? Those are the last two objections we're going to tackle next week. Thank you, guys.